Next case is Naylor Farms v. Chaparral Energy, case number 176146.
Thank you. I'm Tony Shaheen. With me at council table is John Griffin and Jessica Schmidt. They helped me with the briefs, and they helped me prepare for the argument. What I would like to do, with the court's permission, is to take a step back and do what the court in Roderick said. Look at what the trial would look like if this class were certified. And so let's just talk about what would the trial look like if this class certification order stood. Well, the first thing we know is we'd have to start at the wellhead, because Chaparral's contention is every one of its sales, and the court found that somewhere between 85 to 90% of Chaparral's gas sales are at the wellhead. Our contention is they're good faith, arm's length, third-party contracts. The plaintiffs dispute every one of those, but we know this. There are 1,500 wells. There are at least 150 gas contracts for those 1,500 wells that spread throughout the whole state of Oklahoma. And in order to contest our good faith, the plaintiffs are going to have a trial on every one of those gas contracts to determine the circumstances of the negotiations, whether or not the price is fair, and then the motives. Were the processors and Chaparral in cahoots? Did we enter into those contracts?
The contracts you're talking about are not the royalty contracts.
No, Your Honor.
Contracts with the midstream purchaser.
It is the sale at the wellhead to the purchaser. Yes, Your Honor. They're not the royalties. They're not the leases.
In that sale, the midstream purchaser becomes the owner.
He does. Title transfer. There's no dispute. Title to the gas transfers.
And that midstream purchaser maintains ownership until it goes in the gas transmission line, pipeline.
Until the processor sells it to a third party. Yes.
And back at the wellhead, at that time, the purchaser pays something to the midstream buyer, or the midstream buyer pays something to Chaparral.
Yes, most of the contracts are POP contracts, and then
after they pay that, they maintain title until it goes into the gas transmission line, at which time it turns into the property of the interstate pipeline. Right.
Yeah. If I followed you, Your Honor, they is the purchaser maintains title.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, but there's a payment at the wellhead to Chaparral, but there's also a further payment to Chaparral before it goes into the gas transmission line, right?
No, that's in some circumstances, Your Honor, that might be true, but in the bulk of the sales for the POP contracts, Chaparral doesn't get paid until after the processor turns around and sells that gas to the transmission company, if you will.
Then I'm confused. I thought you said Chaparral got paid at the wellhead.
It does, Your Honor.
And so it gets a second payment on down the line.
No, Your Honor. The way the pricing works is there's a formula. Instead of the cash changing hands right away, it changes hands after the processor sells the gas to the third party. And in the Fawcett case out of Kansas, the Supreme Court of Kansas described it, much like we would describe it, as a pricing formula agreement. It's just a formula.
But that seems odd to me that would occur that way when Chaparral, according to you, has given up all right, title, and interest at the wellhead.
It is, Your Honor. But the advantage, as our expert testified, is this. Chaparral gets to take the upside, and sometimes perhaps the downside, of the marketing of the processor. And so we are now in a shared community of interest. The processor wants to get the highest price it can for the gas, and our price at the wellhead is determined by what the processor gets. So it's really, assuming prices go up, it's a great situation.
It's a great deal.
It's also a great deal for the royalty owners, because their royalty is calculated on the price, and if we get a higher price, they get, using one-eighth, they get one-eighth of that higher price.
Okay, so are you telling me then that the royalty owner and the lessors, that they get not just the price at the wellhead, but they also get a bump as participating in the price that when it goes into the transmission line.
Well, I'm a little nervous, Your Honor, and about the bump. And there really is only one price. There's a contract that has the formula in it. We get paid, as is Chaparral, gets paid after the gas is sold to the transmission line. So there really is only one payment for the typical POP contract.
Are you when you say there's only one payment, there's only one payment to the royalty owner?
Well, to Chaparral, too.
Well, okay. Let's talk about the royalty owner. The royalty owner is paid one price, and that is what is received at the wellhead.
No. The royalty owner gets his price based on what the processor sells the gas to the transmission line. It's a pricing formula. So, for example, it usually gets split out something like 75-25. But the important part is this. It's a pricing formula. Chaparral gets its check after the processor sells the gas to the third-party transmission line. Chaparral then calculates the royalty. Assume for a moment the royalty is 1/8. The royalty owner gets 1/8 of that price.
And the final price that is paid for the gas as it enters the interstate pipeline.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I missed the first part of that.
Okay. Do they participate in the 1/8 of the total price that is received by Chaparral when the gas enters the pipeline?
Yeah, they participate in the 1/8 of the price that Chaparral gets based on the sale.
But it's the growth. It's the Chaparral's getting a net price.
Well,
they're getting a price that already has all the services and the cost of that included in that, or it accounts for that. And then they're giving the royalty owners the percentage of that based on the gross, which that means the royalty owners are then paying to make the gas marketable. And that's the problem, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, because the price is a calculated price based on what the processor sells the gas for. The argument they're making is that...
But it's already had services. By that point, by the time that it's eventually the exchange happens, it's undergone all the services to make it marketable.
Well, no, that's...
And so Chaparral's paying for those services in that it comes out of their price, but then they're also pushing that price that they, you know, they're then taking their gross.
No,
they're using the royalty based on that, but that's had the servicing cost taken out of it. So I'm confused. I'm confused about your position. I don't understand why the class as certified isn't appropriate. The class as certified takes it's only based on the middle stat clauses, right?
It is based on the middle stat, yes.
And they're all consistent in that regard. All the contracts are consistent in that regard.
They are. But what's inconsistent is what you have to look at. Let me back up to say something, Your Honor. The gas is marketable when it's in a position to be bought in a marketplace. Our position is that the gas is in marketable condition at the wellhead because there's a market there for it. Now, why does the processor buy it?
But are you actually selling at the wellhead?
Yes. Yes.
And are any of the contracts or any of the wells that are part of this certified class, would they be subject to that? Does that make sense? Go ahead and say that. This is a confusing set of facts. I guess what I'm asking you is your brief talks about the fact that gas is marketable, and I don't see at the wellhead. But I don't see anybody disputing that, but I guess I don't understand the relevance of that to this particular certified class.
Because the implied duty to market under Oklahoma law and under Kansas law, which we rely on in the Fawcett case, is once I've got the gas, the producer that is, has the gas in the condition where it's fit to be sold in the marketplace, I have then satisfied my obligations to the class. Our argument is, and the court found, it's sold at the wellhead, in an arm's length 30 third-party transactions. Our duties are then satisfied. What the processor does with it afterwards is its business. But the whole reason for that sale and the whole reason for the existence of the processing plant is to take that gas and then to manufacture, or actually manufacture is the wrong word, but to process it and turn it into something different. It is no different, Your Honor, than if I'm a wheat farmer and I sell my wheat to a miller, and the miller grains it and then sells it to General Mills. You can tell I'm not a wheat farmer. Sells it to General Mills. The raw wheat is the feedstock for the mill. In this case, the gas as it comes out of the ground is the feedstock. And we know that, Your Honor, if we look at the gas purchase contracts, the contracts, and there's several of them in the appendix. You'll go through this. They like to use the word raw gas to suggest this is junk, but it's not. There are qualifications and specifications that the gas has to meet before the purchaser will take it. And it's a very interesting point. With the exception of the liquids, the NGLs or the BTUs, all of the specs are minimums or zeros. I'm sorry, maximums or zeros. The BTUs are minimums. Why is that? The processor won't take the gas unless it's got a minimum BTU content. Why? Because that's where it makes its money. It processes the gas, takes the liquids out, and sells the residue gas in the liquids. It's buying the gas, as reflected in the contracts, to get the BTU value. So there's a market here at the wellhead, and there's a market here at the outlet of the plant. There may be intervening markets, but for our purposes, one here and one there. And this case stands in sharp contrast to the California Company versus Udall case that they cited in their brief. Because in that case,
I hate to interrupt you, but could you tie what you're saying back into the issue here that you're challenging, which is commonality and typicality?
Oh, sure.
Could you try to tie it back in for us?
Because if they are, as we contend, true sales at the wellhead, and then we've fulfilled our duty to market. We're done. We've satisfied our obligations under Mittelstaedt and under Oklahoma law. So in order for them to attack that, they have to contest that these are true wellhead sales. It is what the Court of Appeal...
Well, they say there's no evidence that there are any of those true wellhead sales going on. That's just not happening here.
Well, we have an expert that testified. We had a marketer that testified. But more importantly, we have over 150 wellhead contracts, each of which will have to be examined, and they're third-party, arm's-length contracts. You can't just condemn a whole industry, which, in fact, in the Fawcett case, which I like...
What did your experts say about this in response to the idea that this is just not... It's not relevant here because it's not happening. What did the experts say about
that? What the experts say is the pop contract idea came into being, the situation was that the producers were selling their gas to a fixed fee to the processors who had no interest in getting the maximum value out of the gas. Phillips came up with the idea, and our expert is someone that worked at Phillips and was involved in the discussions, of turning these things into pop contracts whereby everybody shares in the upside. We get a higher price. One of the things about these contracts is a lot of them are what we call life of the lease contracts, and that means I enter into a contract with this processor for the life of the lease. I am tied to a price. And what the concern was is, geez, if the price goes up and I'm tied to this contract, I'm out of luck. And so the idea came up, we're going to use this so that everybody wins. It's an upside situation. But again, our obligation under Mittelstaedt and the implied duty to market is to put the gas such that it's fit for sale in a commercial marketplace. Our argument is these are third-party, arm's-length, good-faith contracts. There's a marketplace at the well. And what I was going to say about California Company versus Udall, the situation in there is different because, as the court said, there was no market at the wellhead. But it does say if there was a market, this would have been good, the sale would have been good. And the other point is this. The sale contract said the processor would take the gas as it came out of the ground, but it had to be in the condition suitable for a transmission line. Our contracts don't say that. And so what you have to determine is there a market? And the important thing is this. Middlestat recognizes, as did Wood and other cases out of Oklahoma, that there can be a sale of the gas at the wellhead. So you just can't dismiss it.
Has Oklahoma recognized that gas can be marketable at the wellhead?
Yes, indeed. At least three times
Have they been inconsistent about that, though?
I'm sorry?
Have they been inconsistent about that?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think because
What about on federal leases? Is that so on federal leases? That they've recognized there's a market?
That I don't know, Your Honor, but these are not federal leases.
I understand that, but we're talking about generally the concept of market, so you're not going to dodge that question just because these are not federal leases.
I don't know the answer, so I'm not trying to dodge it.
Well,
I don't know the federal leases.
In the briefing.
I mean, the issue, but the important thing is this. What Middlestat is insistent about is that this is a question of fact. Marketability is a question of fact. Middlestat could have done what they're arguing and say gas isn't marketable until it's fit for transmission into the interstate pipeline. Middlestat never did that. It stayed away from it, and it said again a number of times it is a question of fact. And
some states have, though, defined a point at which it becomes marketable.
I'm not aware of any state, Your Honor, that's defined marketability by saying it has to be fit for sale. Colorado has not done that. In the Rogers case, there's a couple places in there where it says it can be fit for sale at the wellhead. Kansas, of course, the Supreme Court absolutely rejected that argument. So I'm not aware, and they have not cited any case where a court has had that definition.
Mr. Sheen, the reason why I asked the questions initially about ownership as the gas progressed from the wellhead to gathering and processing and then ultimately to the transmission line was this. If we're dealing with the problem, is this a real market or is it a facade? And I'm concerned that if it's a real market, then Chaparral should be giving up all right title and interest and have nothing else to do with that gas the moment it sells to the midstream processor. And yet that's not the case. They are participating as it goes down to the transmission line. And that then means to me that maybe there's not a real market at the wellhead if it's dirty gas.
Your Honor, I don't mean to quarrel, but there's nothing in the record.
You're supposed to quarrel.
Okay, I will quarrel. There's nothing in the record that suggests that Chaparral participates once the gas is sold. There's nothing in the record.
Could they participate in this way, and that is the ultimate amount of money they get is determined downstream rather than the money that's paid by the midstream processor at the wellhead. Isn't that correct?
It is. But what difference does that make?
That's what I'm talking about, participation.
But there's no evidence in the record that Chaparral participates in the pricing other than entering into the contract or the marketing or anything. Once that gas, the evidence in the record is, once that gas leaves the wellhead and title changes, Chaparral is done with it. All it needs to do is get a check from the processor.
But it's a check that is different than the amount that it's sold at the wellhead.
Well, there is no check at the wellhead. That's why, at least in this case.
But there's a price.
There's a price.
Okay.
It's a formula.
Okay.
It's a formula.
I back up. There's money change there. But there's a price set.
Yes, but there's it's a pricing
price
formula.
It keeps changing as it, until it reaches the transmission.
Well, Your Honor, would it
that
make any
sense to me? Is it that the market is not at the wellhead?
I know I'm not supposed to ask you questions, but would it make any difference if it was a fixed price? Because in the example they give from now Justice Roberts, out of the Amoco case, which is one of their footnotes, Justice Roberts' argument says the gas is unmarketable, it's a fixed price, you can't deduct the cost charged to process the gas. It doesn't really matter if it's a POP contract or a fixed price. The question is the gas marketable at the wellhead? And the express assumption in the example from Justice Robert and in their two hypotheticals, is that the gas is not marketable at the wellhead. That was the same conclusion that the court of one of the judges on the Court of Appeals in Kansas said, look, it's not marketable until it gets to the interstate pipeline. And the Supreme Court of Kansas said, no, if there is a market.
You need to wrap
it up. I think I've gone way over my time.
You can wrap it up in a sentence if you want.
No, I thank you for your patience.
Yes. Thank you.
And thanks for letting me quarrel.
Certainly. We'll give Appellee some extra time, 5 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Connor Helms for the plaintiffs of this matter. With me today is Dale Naylor of Naylor Farm from Balco, Oklahoma. We appreciate your time and attention. The first thing I'd like to point out is that what the council wants you to do to step back and look what the trial would look like, that's what Judge Heaton did. The standard of review for appeal is different. As this court has said in numerous cases and your opinions have stated, it's not did he make the right decision, did he weigh the evidence, did all that. It's look back, was there abuse of discretion? First, we ask, did the district court apply the correct legal standard? I've read their brief several times, and they haven't said that he didn't. They haven't said really that he did. They just set out a standard, and they don't say did he follow it or not. But based on the record, he did follow that standard. He followed the standard announced by the Supreme Court and by the Tenth Circuit and by this court. And so then we look at it, did Judge Heaton abuse his discretion? Were the findings of fact clearly erroneous? Not we're going to substitute our decisions. Had we been sitting where Judge Heaton was and examined 17 file boxes of evidence and mega data on FOBs. And so were his findings clearly erroneous? They haven't set forth any that are clearly erroneous. They just disagree with his finding. Were his conclusions of law?
You're nibbling all around the edges, you know,
right.
we're talking about. Commonality.
Yes, Your Honor.
And, you know, whether this fits for a class.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what happens at trial is important. We don't want to affirm something that's going to cause just a mess.
Yes, Your Honor.
So,
and so before Judge Heaton, we actually had the evidence, and it's the evidence that's a battle of experts. It's a trial of generalized evidence from Chaparral and from public sources. It is their leases that they produced to us, and so we have before Judge Heaton every lease of our requested class, and he narrowed it to less.
Let's talk about this market thing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, you know, there's this concept the market has spoken. Well, there is a buyer
at
the wellhead. In fact, there are multiple buyers, right?
The experts disagree on that. So that's
you
a battle of the
experts. Buyer?
The evidence before the court from our expert was there's only one line, and based on the deposition testimony from the Chaparral personnel.
For all these thousands of wells, there's only one line.
For each well, there's only one line. They never renegotiate any of these contracts.
Well, okay, but there are multiple processors throughout the state.
There are processing stations throughout the state.
Right, and owned by different people.
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, and so somebody who's off in the northeastern part as a processor could be a competitor in that market in the southeastern.
That's what Chaparral's expert says. Our expert says no, and their deposition testimony says no, because they would have to lay in a very expensive line to this well that's been producing now for 10 years, whose pressure is now low. We're going to have to compress it. The cost of laying that line to go connect to that well is cost prohibitive. That's why there is no market at the wellhead. There is one buyer. Once again,
well,
there's
a market in this sense is that one processor can buy another processor.
That's true, Your Honor.
An acquisition.
They could.
Because this market looks good to me. I'd like to buy this dirty gas at the wellhead.
DCP
I mean,
does
when you have
do
a
that.
Sale, unless that's there's collusion or fraud, fraud's not in this case anymore, right?
Not certified as a class. No, Your Honor.
Okay. So unless there's some type of collusion, there's a market because there's been a sale. You know, the market has spoken.
Several opinions have disagreed that that is actually a pure sale.
Well, okay. They have, what's the basis for their opinion? I mean, we just can't say, you know, we're not dealing with ipse dixit. Tell us why there's a market there and why the experts say there's a market there.
For our class wells, what comes out of the wellhead is not a usable product. It is processed and sold downstream as a usable product. The liquids
well, okay,
are processed
but
out.
I understand, but just because, you know, if I buy a tire rather than a whole car, that tire is not usable. But there's a market for it independent of it on being on a finished automobile.
And if the seller of that tire had an independent duty to market the whole car, but is only selling the tire and you're getting paid on the tire, he's violated his duty to you, Your Honor, of his implied duty to get you the full price of the car. So that's what we have here, and this is why it's not a wheat farmer situation. There is no implied duty to market in his wheat farmer situation. We have here where the royalty owner has given up the right to produce our minerals to Chaparral, and they have, by Oklahoma law, this implied duty to market to us. They haven't fulfilled it, because they are now charging us what it takes to process it, to get it to a usable market, a usable product. And so what we're going to have at the trial is a battle of experts. We either win or lose by them. It is generalized evidence at trial in one setting of approximately 10,000 claims on 3,900 oil and gas leases in one setting, yes or no. Judge Heaton found that that was predominated over any individualized issues. His opinion was reviewed by the bankruptcy court, Judge Silverstein in Delaware. She also found that that was a better method of handling all these proof of class claims. One setting, one time, either you win or you lose by your experts. We have a petroleum engineer, Randy Kaplan. Theirs is a Phillips expert. Ours worked at Texaco, the famous case of Texaco versus Hal versus Texaco.
Let me ask you this. At such a trial, will it be an issue of the Chaparral going after individual royalty agreements and saying there's no IDM there because there's language negating it? Do they go after and pick at this gaggle of leases you have and pick them off?
No, Your Honor, they can't because they're all the same. Judge Heaton limited us to only metal stat clauses. We actually wanted everyone that had the same
effect.
What's
this business they're talking about, that there are exhibits and that there are interlineations that affect this duty to market or the price?
Yes, Your Honor. They make that argument when you look at the record that they cite to. The only ones that are in our class leases, class wells, change the 1/8 to a 3/16. Our leases do not have anything that allows for them. They're expressly excluded. And so we don't have
any thousands of leases we're talking about here?
What is now limited to, based on his ruling of Metalstat, is around approximately 3,900 leases, and they're all the same, except for 1/8 or 3/16. And that's a damage issue that Barbara Lay, our CPA,
so in none of those 3,900 leases, is there any language anywhere, either in typing or interlineation, that changes the duty to market?
No, Your Honor. And that was submitted, actually, in our motion for partial summary judgment to Judge Heaton, which would have been ruled upon, but they filed bankruptcy.
How many leases were in the class that you proposed that he did not accept?
6,500?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. It's in our response brief. There was over 6,000 leases, and so it's almost put down to half. Now 3,900 is what we have in the bankruptcy court now. It's still substantial, and it will benefit, as pointed out by the amicus brief, some royalty owners may only have $100 they haven't been paid. How are they going to afford Randy Kaplan and Barbara Lay, the CPAs and petroleum engineers, to go get their $100? How are they going to afford a lawyer to go get their $100? Who's going to take a case on a percentage for $100? This is the only way to get justice to the masses.
In this trial, then you also have to show what were the processing costs they're inappropriately apportioned to the royalty owners. That's going to be a mess, isn't it?
It's not, Your Honor. It's very simple.
Okay. And tell me how.
Sure. The petroleum engineer and the CPA worked together on that. It comes from Chaparral's general records, and they put it all into spreadsheets and present it to the court or if it were a jury trial, to a jury.
Well, I understand spreadsheets, but what's in them? I mean,
It actually has the makeup from each well into a common proof overlies. We have, in this situation, because we've limited it to all wells in our class are processed, the gas is processed. Not one single well goes directly into an interstate pipeline. Everything is processed, so that simplifies it. If it went to an interstate pipeline, it's excluded from our class, but they've not identified any well
because
in our class.
Because it's clean gas.
None of our wells are that way.
Right. As I understand it, every one of your wells, or every one well in the class, has had some GCDPP, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Gathering, compressing, transporting, dehydrating, and processing. And so every well is the same. Every method of payment to our class members is the same. Everybody's getting deducted.
Is that how you distinguish the Kansas case?
And they make a big point out of that they're the ones that cited Fawcett, which has not been followed in Oklahoma by the Supreme Court of Oklahoma. We just put in our response brief that ours is different from Fawcett because we did challenge the good faith in our pleadings. As where Fawcett, it was not a challenge. And so that was just a distinction. We have not, the good faith and fair dealing has not been certified as a class claim. Only breach of the lease, in damages for breach of those leases. The fiduciary duty claim could be part of that breach as well. But that's up to the trial judge out in Delaware now.
Is there anything if we disagree with you and we think the marketability issue does impact and destroy commonality or typicality, is there anything on remand? Is there anything, any possibility that a class can still be certified?
And I've wrestled with what is the impact of this court reversing, because mm-hmm. it is in bankruptcy court now.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is the practical, is Judge Heaton even allowed to do anything without permission of the bankruptcy court in Delaware? We had to have an agreement of mm-hmm. parties to lift the stay to even get him to rule. I don't believe he has the authority to do anything without Delaware's permission. So they've appealed the Delaware bankruptcy court, Judge Silverstein, her opinion, and we're waiting on a ruling on that. I suppose that the significant part, if you did reverse and remand with directions, they would be notifying Delaware of supplemental authority.
Is the bankruptcy is a Chapter 11?
Yes, Your Honor. The plan has set out a set amount of common stock for this class. I think it's now 7% is what was what I read, I believe.
I guess I'm questioning whether there's any direction that we could give that could help you at this point in terms of class certification.
Your Honor,
I'm asking you to help me there.
Well,
I'm not saying we go that way or we don't, but just I'm kind of struggling with what it is actually the parties want us to do.
In the best case scenario, Your Honor, it would be to affirm Judge Heaton and also to adopt what Judge Silverstein had in her opinion. And that is.
Let's say we disagree with you. That's my premise. Let's say we disagree. We agree that the gas marketability issue. Let's say that the gas marketability issue, we go against you on that. We say there wasn't commonality. There wasn't typicality. We adopt Chaparral's position on that. What would you want? Is there anything that we can do in terms of class certification on remand? Is there anything further you could do to still survive? Does that make sense?
Yes, Your Honor. And I'm trying to think of that hypothetical. Is in this what is before this court that was before Judge Heaton and under the standard of review that was required to go through, if you found that there wasn't commonality.
Is it over?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't see what could be
done. I'm just asking. I guess, yeah. It's over, right? Okay.
I believe so, Your Honor. So
let me follow up. You said, if you could write this, you would be affirming Judge Heaton's determination on class. And then you said something about Judge Silverstein's.
Yes, Your Honor. In her final factor, if you read her opinion, she adds a factor that Chaparral has brought up as an issue on appeal that she shouldn't have added. And she puts in there, if we are correct, if our experts are believed and we're correct by our experts, that they did wrong, they paid us improperly, that this should be a message to the new management in Chaparral going forward not to do this anymore. Well, I think...
Well, you're not suggesting we say that.
No, Your Honor, but I misunderstood the question. I thought, okay, if there's anything we could do to help you. And I think as an industry, the people that, the companies that are doing this, kind of like in the BP case that came out of Colorado, where they hide things. And why is it that Chaparral is changing net to gross when they report to my clients and to the royalty owners? It's because they're hiding it. They're hiding. They are misleading. As you look at Barbara Lay's exhibits, she takes the royalty check, compares it to the plant statements. There's a fictitious price that's reported and a fictitious volume that's reported to the royalty owners every month. Why do they do that? They know it's wrong. They don't look at these lease clauses when they're paying because they don't want to. It's a systematic, we're going to sell at the wellhead because under this formula, we get a check and we're paying you on that check, and that's all that's reported to them. We never get, oh, it's a 80-20 percentage of proceeds or 80-20 75-25 in his example. We never get that information. We have to hire a lawyer.
But that, none of that is any more a part of this lawsuit because it borders on the fraud claim, which is not a claim for this class, right?
No, it's not anymore, Your Honor. As Judge Russell did in the Anadarko case, Judge Leonard did in the Fankhauser XTO case, in the Hill versus Kaiser Francis, on summary judgment, ruled that this is a breach of fiduciary duty to the class, to the royalty owners. This is one of the last few cases that has a breach of fiduciary duty claim in it. Now, what doesn't do us any good out in bankruptcy court really anymore, but had this not been in bankruptcy, as you know, that would shift the burden of proof to Chaparral to show that every transaction somehow benefited the royalty owners. And they can't do that. That's why they got the law changed in Oklahoma, shortly after the Fankhauser XTO case came out. So this court has the opportunity to help this class of 10,000 people that can't afford to do what Naylor Farms has stepped up and what Harrell's LLC has stepped up to do, and that is fight with them for a long, long time. Since 2001, we have been fighting this fight, and we ask this court to affirm Judge Heaton, allow us to go forward in bankruptcy and at least get this class what is now part of a plan. It'll never make them whole, but it's all that they're going
to
get.
Now, as I understand it, you don't go back to 2006, so they go back to 2011?
Right. We had to adopt a date.
And that's 2011?
Right, Your Honor, but we've been fighting a lot longer.
Do you have a number? Is there a number that's somewhere in the record of what the final dollars would be if your position prevailed and the class remained at 3,900?
Prior to the ruling by Judge Heaton, it was around 150 million, I believe. Now, with the narrowing of the class to just the middle stat leases, I believe that was in the bankruptcy filings was somewhere around 90. But still, it's limited to a portion of the 10% of the common stock set aside for unsecured claims. You know, interesting in that case is that Chaparral admitted in the filings that our monies were being held in a fiduciary capacity, but yet they deny in this proceeding that they owe us a fiduciary.
Did I understand you correctly, though, on the plan in the Chapter 11 case that if that plan goes through and you get this class and you prevail, that ultimately what the royalty owners would be converted from royalty owners to shareholders?
That's what is put aside, and I think they've put 7% of the 10% aside for this class proof of claim.
7%
of the 10%
new stock.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so they're doing very well, and we want them to do very well under the new management. We do want them to stop this practice, and those that follow their their lead in doing this. We'd ask this court to affirm Judge Heaton, let us go forward and let the bankruptcy judge decide if we're right or if they're right based upon the battle of the experts. Not a single royalty owner has to testify at this case other than the class rep. This is so much different than the employment cases. Even a lot of the employment cases this court has upheld as a class action. The Walmart Dukes is not even near this. We have centralized decision-making at Chaparral, generalized proof as to the decision to take the class's money on this basis. I really appreciate the court's time and your questions, and on behalf of Naylor Farms and myself, thank you.
Thank you. Time's up. So thank you, parties, and we will take this matter under advisement. Appreciate your arguments. They've been helpful.